Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening to NPR News. This hour, as the Delta variant spreads among people who are unvaccinated, companies are making decisions about whether to mandate the vaccine. Morgan Stanley, Saks Fifth Avenue, and BlackRock are requiring vaccines. United Airlines and Goldman Sachs will require that employees divulge their vaccine status, and they'll strongly encourage vaccines. And if you're asking right now, can they do this? The answer is yes in most cases, and we'll talk about why. We'll also talk about how college campuses are approaching this. A federal judge recently affirmed that Indiana University can require the coronavirus vaccine, although that case is being appealed. Hundreds of colleges and universities say they'll require it too. And if a college or university doesn't require a vaccination, they're going to require frequent testing. So next week, we'll talk about how public schools are handling the new school year and the virus. But today, it's vaccine mandates, companies, and colleges. And as our guests join in, I'd like to know if you think the company or nonprofit that you work for should encourage or should they mandate vaccination. If you teach at a college or attend one as a student, what are you hearing about a vaccination requirement and what do you think about that? So the company or the nonprofit you work for, are they encouraging or mandating vaccinations, or are they requiring that you divulge vaccine status? And if you are on a college campus as faculty or a staffer, or you attend one as a student, what are you hearing about a vaccine requirement, and what do you think about it? The phone number is 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can tweet in at Carrie NPR. Dr. Hilary Babcock is with us, an infectious disease expert at Washington University School of Medicine. She specializes in the prevention of infection transmission in healthcare settings, and she's with us from St. Louis. And Dr. Babcock, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dr. Mike Osterholm is with us, an epidemiologist and the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, with us from St. Louis Park. And Mike, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, thank you.
I want to take a couple of calls for both of you so you can hear where our listeners are coming from on this, and then I want to hear how you're thinking about it. To Beth in South Minneapolis. Hi, Beth. I'm really glad you called. How are you approaching this?
As far as I'm concerned, I'm so sick and tired of the namby-pamby, my constitutional rights. This is a plague. I mean, what part of this is the plague did anybody miss?
And so it sounds like you're saying require the vaccines, yeah?
Require it, mandate it, I don't care. I want to be done with this. And the only way we're going to be done with this is if everybody vaccinates. And the only way everybody's going to vaccinate is if there are consequences for being stupid.
I appreciate the call, Beth, and the view to Kurt in St. Paul. Hi, Kurt. How are you thinking about this?
I agree with your previous caller. My daughter works for a company that does not require vaccination, though I believe they encourage it. And furthermore, they are prohibiting employees from asking coworkers whether or not they are vaccinated.
Okay. Kurt, thank you for the view. Dr. Babcock, so I think we hear listeners there saying this isn't your private business, your vaccine status. It's going to affect the people you're working with. What do you think of that view as we think about mandating vaccines?
Well, I not surprisingly agree that in the perspective that you just put forward. Like, it's a personal decision to the extent that it only affects you personally. And when it affects a lot of other people around you, then it moves beyond personal into a more public health realm. And in a public health realm, we really try to look at it in terms of what is the best way to minimize spread of disease through a population. I think employers are looking across their workforce and recognizing that an unvaccinated workforce is an unprotected workforce and is one that is going to lead to clusters of infection within their employees, is going to lead to people getting sick and lead to people needing to take time off and potentially putting their workforce stability at risk. And that's particularly a concern in areas in healthcare, like where I am, you know, more my perspective comes from, where it's critically important that we have a solid workforce.
Dr. Osterholm, you wrote in the Star Tribune recently about persuasion, education, and incentives, and you said a mandate will give a false sense of safety, which only increases risk. Help me understand that. Why?
Well, first of all, a mandate can't be used as just a simple one concept. Mandates have a variety of different legal implications, depending on where you sit, whether you're a public or private institution, in certain states where you're prohibited from using this kind of information. And our whole point was specific to Minnesota. Minnesota is actually governed in terms of higher education and vaccines by a law that was passed in 1989. I was very involved in helping getting it passed, state epidemiologist at the time, in a sense mandating routine vaccines for college students here on our campuses. I mean, I'm a very, very strongly pro-vaccine individual. But as part of that law, there were exclusion criteria that were put into place that were required. And one of those is that anyone can actually defer out of getting vaccinated. All they have to do is say that they object to getting vaccinated and have a signed form from a notary of the public saying that. And that's what people understand, is in the private sector, in many cases, you have a much wider breadth of ability to enforce certain work standards, workplace requirements than you do in the public mm-hmm. sector. So our mm-hmm. whole point was at the University of Minnesota, right now, if we said you are mandated to get the vaccine, we would have a large number of our people who are not yet there who would just say, I'm not going to get it then, okay, and sign that form. They are one of the three groups of people who get vaccinated or who consider vaccination. Those who are vaccine affirmative, who couldn't wait to get it. They drove 100 miles last March in snowstorms to find a clinic somewhere in rural Minnesota to get it. There are those who are vaccine hesitant that are in the middle that still say, I have questions. I'm a pregnant woman. Will this harm my unborn baby? You know, I'm a young black man. Is this another experimentation of Operation Warp Speed on me, et cetera? And then you have the third group of vaccine hostile. They're going to say, forget it. Under no conditions will I get it. And in this state right now, by the law, they can just sign a form and say, I'm not going to get it. So we really don't need to deal with the affirmative. We don't need to deal with the hostile because they're not going to get it. They legally can get out of it. It's that middle group. And we had a webinar last Friday at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Stephen Thomas, who's one of the most noted black physicians in the country, who's running a major outreach program to educate the black community through black barbers and black beauticians, said, use the word mandate in our community, you're done. It's over with. They're not going to wow. do it. And so part of the challenge we have is how do we get the most number of people vaccinated? And that's the key message. So I think too many people say if it's a mandate, I'm done. I've had professors at the university say to me, well, I'm really upset with you because you're now making it so I can't have a class 100% vaccinated. And that's just the absolute opposite. You would not know if anybody exempted out at the University of Minnesota. And that's true for most of the country. Only 13% of universities and colleges right now are mandating vaccines for the fall. 13%.
Okay.
So I think tells you something right there.
What about that group that Mike Osterholm is talking about, which have a legal exemption? Then you're losing any kind of ability to persuade or incentivize them. Dr. Babcock, are you there?
Sorry, yes. A few comments to follow up on Dr. Osterholm's comments. I agree that a mandate should not be viewed as sort of a one-and-done process. So when an employer or anyone really puts in place a vaccine requirement, it's really important that that does not become the only piece of the vaccine outreach and the vaccine campaign. So the requirement needs to go hand in hand with the education that he was talking about, with outreach, with encouragement, with being sure people have ways to get their questions answered, you know, to be sure that we are helping people get ready for that decision and for that deadline. It's also important to note that there are different ways to enact a mandate and different ways to follow what the impact is. So within healthcare settings, it's important, most of us, when we track the impact of a vaccination program or a vaccination campaign, it's important that we not track compliance rates, because what Dr. Osterholm is talking about is really a compliance rate. So you could get a 100% compliance with your policy at the University of Minnesota and still only have 60 or 70% vaccinated, if it's as easy as he's describing to get an exemption to the process. And so that wouldn't necessarily, you know, that might give you a false sense of safety if all you report is a 100% compliance rate and not a 60% vaccination rate. Within the private sector and for healthcare employers, we are bound by laws that require that we provide a process for people to get medical exemptions if they have medical reasons that they are unable to get vaccinated, and are bound by federal laws around religious accommodations, that if people have a deeply, sincerely held religious conviction opposed to vaccination, that they also can be allowed an exemption as long as their workplace can accommodate them, can give them other ways to keep themselves and others around them safe. So I do think that it's a little bit different. There are some nuances in what you call a mandate or a requirement or a condition of employment and how it is implemented across different work sites and different employers. And a community level mandate for a vaccine is very different than an employer-based mandate for a vaccine.
Let's go back to the phones here. So you have heard our guests, Dr. Hilary Babcock and Dr. Mike Osterholm, tease out some of the nuance and the complications of an idea of just saying, hey, everybody's got to get vaccinated and that's it before we go back to work and play and other venues. It's complicated. We're going to talk that through. Employers, some of whom are already making this decision, are backed up by the EEOC to require a vaccination. But does that get them to the high vaccine compliant rate that they're looking for? I mean, does that provide the kind of safety in the workplace that they're seeking? And that's some of the complexity of the conversation. So as you think about this, I want to know whether you think the company or the nonprofit you work for should encourage or mandate vaccinations. If you teach at a college or you attend one as a student, what are you hearing about a vaccination requirement, and what do you think about it? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. To Kimberly. Hi, Kimberly. I really appreciate you waiting. I'm glad you did. It sounds like you own a business. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I own a small, like, sort of family dental practice in the Minneapolis metro area, sort of right in the city. And we, as owners, my husband and I, are very, very pro-vaccine, but our staff comes from all over the state and have very disparate political views and views on the vaccines. But we're located in a place where everyone who's walking in assumes we're vaccinated. Everyone is very pro-vaccine, and we haven't gone as far as mandating vaccines. We've certainly encouraged it, but we're trying to sort of find this balance of being transparent with our clientele and make sure they're feeling comfortable, but manage, you know, personal choice in medical, you know, in the medical area.
So when a patient asks, is your whole staff vaccinated, you want to be able to say yes, but you're not going to be able to for now. Is that right?
Exactly. And what my fear is that the patients are not asking because they're assuming the answer is yes. And I don't want to put anyone in a place of risk when they don't want to be.
Dr. Osterholm, what do you do about that?
Oh, I think, first of all, this really goes to the heart of what I was trying to describe, is the challenge of how do we bring people along. Remember, exemption are going to change by where you work, private, public, whatever. And so in a sense, you have to go with the conditions that legally you're able to do. And the other thing I want to add that, and I think this was implied in the call just now, you know, I think there is a moral imperative for healthcare workers to be vaccinated. I just, you know, if you're going to put patients at risk because of your infection, I think that this is just an unacceptable career type situation. At the same time, you can't know how many people in long-term care in particular have contacted me not happy with that approach, because they're saying, you know what, right now 50% of our staff are not vaccinated, which is one of the reasons why we continue to see transmission in long-term care to fully vaccinated elderly individuals, which is a real problem.
That is mind-blowing, Mike. That just makes no sense.
The problem with that is because who works in those jobs? It's often BIPOC community members. It's people who are paid minimum wage. And I've had long-term care administrators say to me, if I have to mandate vaccine for all these employees, I lose half my workforce tomorrow, and these people are going to be laying in their feces for days. And so now the question becomes, wait a minute now. You're saying that the workforce issues are that tight that you can't find people to work in long-term care if you mandate to get vaccinated? They said, yes, this is absolutely the case. And so I think one of the problems is, you know, we have to look at this in the totality of all the issues here. Again, healthcare workers in general, you know, when the situation happened in Houston, and Dr. Babcock's well aware of this, you know, up to 25% of our healthcare workers not willing to take the vaccine yet. If you suddenly put a mandate in place and you tell people they're fired if they don't basically get vaccinated, they found that, you know, basically of the 150 workers at the Houston Methodist Hospital wouldn't get vaccinated, they just left the organization. And today we have a really tight workforce, particularly for certain specialties in healthcare. Now, that's not a reason why you shouldn't get vaccinated, but I'm just pointing out it's not as straightforward and simple as people think. So what's the greater risk to the public? So I, again, want to reiterate, I am morally, absolutely supportive of healthcare workers must be vaccinated. But at the same time, a realist says, what does that mean?
Yeah, Dr. Babcock, as a specialist in healthcare transmission, boy, I really get the moral argument here, but it is hard to ignore the reality of the job market and what it takes to keep these institutions going. They need their workers. What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. And this is a disconnect between acute care medicine and long-term care. Where in acute care medicine, vaccination rates are in general higher than they are in long-term care, and probably that reflects many of the issues that Dr. Osterholm mentioned. In acute care medicine, the vaccination rates are usually higher, and the risk of losing half of your workforce is a lot lower. The 150 that left Houston Methodist was less than 1% of their 25,000 employees. So in the end, it was while a lot of people expressed concern when they announced their mandate, they were only at about 75% vaccinated, and they got to, you know, 99% vaccinated with their mandate. In the acute care setting, we have data that shows that a mandate is the best way, mostly based around influenza vaccination, that a mandate is the best way to get to and sustain high levels of vaccination among our providers, which, again, I think we on the call, at least the three of us all agree, is very important in a healthcare setting. I think that the long-term care questions and the staffing questions there are very important, and I think that it does require some consideration and some nuance around what those jobs look like. But I think also takes place in a much bigger picture around how long-term care is funded, how long-term care facilities are staffed. And long-term care facilities for a long time have not been subject to the same levels of oversight and regulation that acute care hospitals have been, and so are kind of lagging behind in terms of these quality metrics and in getting, you know, sort of staff on board for some of these interventions.
Let me take some calls here. If you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, try us back, and I want to hear from a number of people here. To Tony in Brainerd. Hi, Tony. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, you're welcome.
What's your situation with this?
Well, actually, I own a small business here in Brainerd, and mm-hmm. we deal with the general public all day long. And I've had conversations with, I can't say everybody, but I would guess probably 60% of our customers, and a lot of them don't really care if we have a vaccination, and a lot of them don't really want the vaccination mandated. And for myself, as a small business owner, I go, that is kind of along the same lines of my thinking as well, as leave it up to the people if they would like to have that.
So, Tony, you're saying your customers have, when you've asked the customers, they say, I don't care whether your staff is vaccinated or not.
Correct. And honestly, they don't even really, they don't even say, or they say they don't even care if their own family's vaccinated. A lot of people that really aren't wanting this.
Yeah.
From just the, I'm not a scientific person. I'm not holding this big, I don't want to know what you call it, where we go through the general population and say,
Tony, I think I have the idea of where you're coming at this, and I appreciate the insight on that. To Tim in Plymouth, Minnesota. Hi, Tim. Hey, Tim,
Hello.
You there? Hi.
I am.
What'd you want to say about this?
Well, I think that there's two things. One, we already require vaccinations to get into schools, right, to play sports. And when do we come to the point where we recognize that the public health approach isn't working anymore? Other countries have had their, their law enforcement people, ticket people, OSHA could come in and require any worker. I just feel like there's a need to kind of recognize that we've done what public health can do to encourage. It's time to bring in other systems to kind of enforce.
Okay. I appreciate the insight on this. And Bill adds on Twitter, since you mentioned other countries, this month the French mandated proof of vaccination to enter a restaurant. Then over a million French citizens signed up to be vaccinated. Nobody's wearing masks to enter public buildings. I think they are getting ready, though, to come back into a mask mandate in some parts of France, which are required for unvaccinated in Minnesota. Proof passports are a must. Dr. Ostrom, do you think our caller is right that we've done what we can do via public health messaging to encourage people to do this? Now it's time to bring out the sticks. And if it isn't absolute mandates, it's tougher messaging and tougher maybe incentives to get this done.
Well, I think the challenge we have here is, again, just taking a look at what can actually be done. And what I mean by that is, if you look at, again, in Minnesota, at least specifically, if you look at schools, and this is true for colleges as well as K through 12, there is an exemption component to all of that. And it hasn't been used that often for mumps, measles, and rubella. People generally would agree with that their children should be vaccinated, et cetera. So I think we have to be very careful about assuming COVID, a vaccine that, first of all, is not yet fully licensed, which we hear about all the time. I still don't believe that that's a reason not to get people vaccinated, but it surely is a red flag to some. We have a vaccine yet that people are still saying, well, we really don't know that much about it yet. It's only been available for about 8 to 10 months. I want to learn more. And that is so different than what we see with childhood immunizations that were well-researched, a body of years of data before it was there. Finally, you have this vaccine-hostile group, just like whether it's masking, vaccines, whatever, which is very challenging in terms of the disinformation that's out there. And so that we have people who have really strongly, strongly held views, just as we heard the first caller had a strongly held view about getting vaccinated, which, I tend to be on that side. But the others who are convinced that, this is the Gates Foundation putting a chip inside of you so that they can follow you. This is on and on and on, all the disinformation stories. So it's not just as simple as telling people to do this. And we are going to see a lot more litigation as these mandates come to play. What I don't want to have that do is get in the way of working with those who are in that vaccine hesitant group, not the vaccine hostile. They're done. We can't do anything with them. You can mandate it. Good luck. Legally, they're going to go at it. But I want them vaccinated. But the vaccine hesitant, we are making progress right now. And that's what we want to keep doing, is giving us the time and the effort to make sure that we can get as many of those people vaccinated as possible, as quickly as possible. This surge this summer is going to be real. If you're not vaccinated, you can't run the game clock out. This virus will find you eventually. And that's what we have to help people understand.
Dr. Babcock, I want to ask you about what Mike just said about FDA authorization, because you hear people who are hesitating or haven't prioritized getting the vaccine that, well, if the FDA gives it full authorization, that's when I'll get the vaccine. I have to say, I just question that. I don't know how well-versed many of these people actually are on the process of emergency authorization and what the real difference is. It seems to me like an excuse. I'd love to hear how you see this.
Well, I think that it's an easy thing to point to for people that are hesitant or have concerns, for people who are sort of late adopters of new things in general. It's an easy thing to point to. We've done a lot here at our organization to explain why, like, the difference for these vaccinations, why they came through under emergency authorization instead of full licensure, that the difference was really down to how long they had to have follow-up for, that they were allowed to submit for authorization with 2 months of efficacy and safety data instead of 6 months, which is what's required for full licensure, but that was really the only difference, that they went through the same testing requirements, they went through the same requirements for the way that the vaccines were studied, the same, you know, outcome definitions, just that they didn't have quite as long a follow-up. But also point out that now we do, right? So now they've submitted for licensure. We do have the same follow-up, that there were more people involved in these studies than were involved in studies for many other vaccines that have already been fully licensed, and that these vaccines have been given to, you know, millions of people now with very careful monitoring of outcomes afterwards, and that people who were in the studies are now a year out from getting the vaccine, so we're getting more data all the time. But I agree with you that people don't understand the nuances of that, and it's sort of an easy thing to point to. I do wish personally that the FDA would sort of hurry up.
Get going on this,
Full licensure. I don't think anyone has any real concerns that it's not going to be licensed. I mean, it's clearly safe, it's clearly effective, and I think it would be a big help to have that come through. I do want to just add from the other part of the conversation, I do think that we have sort of competing problems in the United States that make this sort of process more complicated, and one is clearly the sort of individualistic culture, and that you can't tell me what to do and that I get to make decisions about what's important for me. And that's a challenge for public health interventions and public health motivation across the country. But I think we also have to be clear that we are also suffering under active disinformation campaigns. So it's not just that people, you know, worry a little bit, but that there are people who are actively trying to fan those flames of worry, who are actively spreading incorrect information. So I know a lot of people in public health are like, oh, if we had messaged this differently, maybe this would be going differently. And I just think we have to be clear that there's active disinformation out there. It's not that people didn't like the public health messaging. It's that they found other streams of messaging that are just feeding them incorrect information. And that is really hard to overcome. We have a mandate at my organization, and as we've put that requirement into place, we have seen a big increase in our vaccination rates. And I do think that some of the vaccine hesitant are sort of waiting on a deadline or a reason to do it sooner. And some of them, the mandates will help. Not all of them, I agree, but some of them, a deadline actually does help.
Dr. Hillary Babcock with us from the Washington University School of Medicine, and Dr. Mike Osterholm with us, of course, from the University of Minnesota. Your calls and questions about the idea of mandating vaccinations before many of us go back to work and play and other venues, and why it's a lot more complicated than just issuing some blanket vaccination requirement. On the other side of news, I want to talk about what employers could do about disincentivizing employees from waiting. You know, the way they do, the way some employers do with smoking, it gets more expensive with your health care insurance if you don't, if you smoke, if you don't have the vaccine. What about an incentive like that? 651-227-6000. And then talk to me this morning about where you work and how the mandates are affecting where you work. Especially would like to hear from healthcare workers on this. 800-242-2828. Tweet in at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil. Sorry I'm a little late coming to you, what are you reporting on?
Good morning, Kerri. President Biden and Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi are set to announce that they have come to an agreement to end the U.S. military's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. The American military mission stated purpose was to help Iraq defeat the Islamic State group. The plan to shift to a strictly advisory and training role by year's end will be spelled out in a broader communique to be issued by the two leaders following their White House meeting today. The U.S. has largely left Afghanistan after 20 years of fighting there. Today, the U.N. issued a report saying more women and children were killed and wounded in Afghanistan in the first half of 2021 than any year since 2009. The report counted a 47% increase in the number of all civilians killed and wounded in violence across the country in the first 6 months of this year. New high-level face-to-face talks between U.S. and Chinese diplomats highlight sharp differences between the two countries, but the tone today appears to be somewhat less contentious than at a similar meeting last year. China has issued a long list of demands and complaints accusing the U.S. of trying to contain or suppress China's development. The U.S. is urging cooperation on issues including climate change, Iran, and North Korea. The talks are taking place near Beijing. And baby salmon are dying by the thousands in one California river, and an entire run of endangered salmon could be wiped out in another. Fishermen who make their living off of adult salmon once they enter the Pacific Ocean are sounding the alarm as heat waves and extended drought in the U.S. West raise water temperatures and imperil fish from Idaho to California. A crash in 1 year's class of young salmon can have lasting effects on the total population and shorten or stop the fishing season. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
How fast can you climb a wall that's at least 50 feet high? In Tokyo, competitors are given a 6-minute window to put their Spider-Man skills to the test. The winner will make Olympic history. We'll get to grips and get a guide to one of the newest sports featured in the Summer Games. Sports climbing, next time on 1A. Stay tuned for 1A at 10 a.m. here on NPR News.
At 11, St. Cloud Police Chief Blair Anderson is one of only four black police chiefs in the entire state of Minnesota. We'll talk with him about building trust with the community and the future of policing at 11.
Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., the House begins hearings on why insurrectionists were able to breach Capitol security on January 6th and what they did once they got in. We'll have full coverage tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Support comes from Comcast Business, helping with whatever the day brings. They'll handle it with gig speeds and cybersecurity solutions. Every day in business is a big day. Comcast Business will help prepare for what's next. Business.comcast.com, powering possibilities.
Back to the conversation now, Dr. Hillary Babcock, an infectious disease expert and at Washington University School of Medicine, as she specializes in the prevention of infection transmission in healthcare. And Mike Osterholm with us, an epidemiologist, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Ostrom, I want to ask you about this idea of where employers step in with employees who smoke, and they may make it more expensive on their health care premiums, and they use a kind of, I guess what I think of as negative incentives to get people to, quit a habit or contribute to what they see as the common good of the organization and lower health care costs. Is that a path that might be effective once the FDA fully authorizes and more of us are back in our offices? What do you think?
I think anything that we can use today to get people vaccinated that actually does not turn them off to vaccination is, in fact, a very positive thing. And this is an incentive-induced kind of effort. So I think, sure, put it out there. Go with whatever we can like this to get people vaccinated.
Call here from Carl in St. Paul. Hi, Carl. You're a college student. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm going to be a second year this fall.
Glad you called. So what's the story with the school that you're going back to?
Well, I go to Grinnell College, and they have actually, I don't know if mandate is the right word, but required at least vaccines for all students that are coming. And the deadline already passed, actually, to submit your proof of vaccination to the school.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from your friends and fellow students down there about it?
Yeah, well, from what I've heard, nobody is really upset about the requirement. Everybody's for it. And the student body, from who I've met and talked to, they're not very hesitant about getting a vaccine, and everybody was trying to get one as soon as possible. And a lot of that, I feel like, comes from us missing most of our first year. We were only there for one quarter of the year. So I feel like there's more people want to get the vaccine to be actually on campus.
That's like an incentive, right? A pretty powerful incentive. If you want to be back on campus living the college life, you have to get the vaccine.
Right, yeah.
Good luck with going back for your sophomore year, and I'm really glad you called. To David in Stillwater. Hi, David. How's this working in your household?
Well, currently my wife is a home care physical therapist for a line of home care, and she's seeing daily that people are asking if you are vaccinated and meeting them in the driveway even. Don't come into our house unless you are vaccinated. And Alina home care has put out a policy saying you don't have to tell them that it's private information and it's not.
Well, David,
they're starting to say that the flu is going to be mandated, but why isn't COVID mandated to be for employees to have it? It's just kind of a crazy world out
there. So I want to be clear on this.
Yes.
Your wife works for Alina, and they are saying you don't have to divulge your vaccine status and you don't have to be vaccinated?
That's correct. And the pushback is there's some people with serious immunocompressed. Dr. Ostrom reported, that it's like a moral obligation, and I feel like Alina is not meeting this moral obligation of getting vaccinated and protecting their patients fully.
Dr. Babcock, what may be the consequences of some of these health organizations who aren't going to mandate and who may have employees who, in the long run, resist a vaccine?
Well, I think there are a couple of different ways to look at consequences. So one is that having an unvaccinated workforce in a healthcare delivery organization increases risk for transmission of infection to patients or between employees that can affect the workforce and the ability to provide care. And I think that's critical. And I really do agree with Dr. Osterholm that especially in healthcare organizations, having a vaccinated workforce, I do think it's an expectation. I think in general, patients coming to our hospitals, patients getting home care services, expect that the person coming to them is not bringing with them a new infection, but is in fact doing everything they can to protect their patients and to keep them healthy. Home care is similar to long-term care, though, in that not the physical therapists that are going to the homes like the caller just alluded to, but some home care aides and home health aides are in similar sort of lower wage positions and have other options to go to for other jobs that might not require vaccination. And so the employer really has to look at what the risk is and balance that risk for a condition of employment and maintaining their workforce and keeping their patients safe. And again, doing everything else that they can potentially before putting in a condition of require of employment that will provide good information, that will make vaccine available quickly and easily and conveniently, have people available to answer questions, community outreach, all of those things to really try to bring people along.
Yeah, Lynn tweets, if long-term healthcare workers were paid a livable wage, they would be incentivized to get a mandated vaccination rather than quitting. Call here from Dennis in North Oaks. Hi, Dennis.
Hello there. Say, I've had this thought from early on when people didn't want to vaccinate their children. And I said, the insurance companies should, if you do not vaccinate your child and your child ends up with polio, measles or whatever, and ends up in the hospital or needs health care, that bill would be on those parents to pay out of pocket themselves. Now that we're in a national emergency here, I think the insurance companies should mandate that if you are not vaccinated, that cost of your hospital bill, if you end up in the hospital in an ICU unit, is the responsibility of you. I don't care if it throws you into bankruptcy. I don't care what it does. It is a national emergency that this gets done and put a lien on their home or whatever. But it seems like if you hit people in the pocketbook, they will start to move in the right direction.
Dr. Ostrom, that's a pretty big stick. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is gets into the challenge and the slippery slope again of what can we get people to do to basically take care of themselves. And again, I want to reaffirm, I want to get everybody vaccinated. But, you know, I've heard this discussion before, and the first response back is, well, then we should basically say to those who are well overweight, we shouldn't pay for their heart attacks. For those who speed in their automobile collisions, we shouldn't pay for their emergency room care. If you're drinking and driving, or you have a drinking or chemical abuse problem, and you have a health consequence, we shouldn't pay for that. So I think that does get into a very slippery slope discussion. What I often find is it more alienates more people than helps. So, I mean, I appreciate the spirit of what was meant here, try to find incentives to get people vaccinated. But I think also we have to understand that, you know, once we start using healthcare in a sense as a target, as a bullet, then it gets much more difficult. If you can use it for incentives, as you talked about earlier, then I think we're in a little better place. And that's, to me right now, is where we really want to concentrate. How do we get people incentivized to do the right thing?
Yeah, Dr. Babcock, one of the things that we're thinking through here in this show is acknowledging that it can be a difficult choice for employers to, you know, to say, I know there's an intersection here over the personal domain of your body and what you decide to do with it, with the power of a corporation, right, making decisions about that domain. And I know that it makes a lot of employers nervous and it makes their employees nervous about it. I'm trying to think if there are other situations where, not with kids and vaccines in schools, but can you think of any other situation where we are having to work through such a thorny ethical situation for employers when it comes to, you know, health and common good?
Well, I think the last words you said there are the important ones, that it's a common good, it's a public health perspective, and that is a little bit of a different perspective for many employers that are outside of the healthcare realm. It's not new for healthcare employers, many of whom who have been requiring a range of vaccines for their employees for a long time now. So it's not as new for us as it is for some other employers. And I think that the lens that may be helpful is the viewpoint of the risk to your other employees, as well as the risk to your clients and customers, and the risk to your ability to deliver whatever services it is that you're delivering. And all of those things then come into play in terms of deciding what's the most important way to encourage high levels of vaccination among your employees. And I agree with Dr. Osterholm that while I am honestly sympathetic to the desires expressed by the last caller to try and really move things forward and sort of change the calculus for people in terms of responsibility, I don't think we should leverage what is essentially a dysfunctional American healthcare payment system in a way that could end up with people bankrupted or, you know, putting a lien on their home due to these kinds of decisions. And I think the incentive process for those is better. So ways that you can maybe have a slight decrease in your premium, or you can have some improvement in your coverage if you can demonstrate that you stopped smoking, or you can demonstrate that you've gotten all recommended vaccines, or that you've met, you know, all of your recommended health prevention measures. I think that incentive is a little bit better. I do think that it depends also about what is happening where you are. So here in Missouri, we are not waiting for our next surge. We are smack in the middle of our fourth surge. And so we are watching our hospitalization rates have quadrupled since the beginning of June until now, with the number of COVID patients we have in our multi-hospital system that we're affiliated with. And we are watching our case rates go up in our communities, and we are watching our ICUs get full again. And we are bringing back mask mandates at work and also in our local communities because the numbers are getting so high. And that's possible because our vaccination rates are not as high as they should be, and because of the spread of the new, more contagious variants. But I think those also, you know, putting in place a mandate during a time when your case rates are low and your vaccination rates are high, and you have to think about sort of the selling points and the risk benefit for your specific situation and your specific area.
You know, Mike, I was going to ask you, given what you said about the what you believe is the moral imperative of, if you work in a healthcare setting, getting the vaccine. If you needed some kind of procedure in a healthcare facility, let's say a hospital, and you weren't confident that there was a full vaccination compliance, how would you handle that? I mean, this is going to be very difficult for some people who can't get the vaccine and need some kind of healthcare that's going to expose them potentially to people who are not vaccinated. Mike, what do you think? Ah, we might have lost his line there. We'll see if we can get him back. Let me grab a call here from Deanna in Minneapolis. Hi, Deanna. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a staff member at Augsburg University and in Minneapolis, and we recently unionized. And one of the big reasons that we unionized in the first place was that decisions were being made for a lot of our staff about being on campus during the pandemic when it was before the vaccination. And these unilateral decisions are being made that really affect people that we want to have a decision about. We want to be part of the decision-making process. And recently our president just sent out another mandate that we are going to require students to be vaccinated before returning to campus. And we're unionized, so why don't we have a say in that decision-making?
So have you, I mean, as with the clout of the union, have you felt like you've been able to have some input on that, on those decisions?
Well, we're supposed to be able to have input on unilateral decisions, but no, it's been a really slow process of negotiations, and we're having a really hard time moving forward with our union as a whole.
Okay. I appreciate the insight on your workplace there. Here's Brian, who says, your right to liberty ends where others' rights to life begins, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. vaccines protect other people, particularly the young and the immune compromised. I'm not worried for myself. I'm worried for the cancer patients, the children, et cetera. And Dr. Babcock, that's what makes this as, and we're kind of coming full circle here, that's what makes this so complicated, is you are not just making a decision that's going to affect you, your family, and your household. If you are not vaccinated, you are making a decision that's going to affect the people who come into your, you know, your space and your orbit. And I don't know, that message, especially you being in Missouri, does not seem to be getting through to some people.
Yeah, I do. I will say that in Missouri, our vaccination rates have started to rise over the last few weeks. And I do think that part of that is that some people thought we were done, thought that the pandemic was essentially over. They had made it through that far without having to get vaccinated. They watched the case rates go down and things were looking pretty good. And then when we removed masking recommendations and reopened, you know, more businesses and social venues and things like that, and our vaccinations stalled out, and we've seen this big rebound of cases. And so some people are getting vaccinated now, I think, because they're seeing, oh, you know, it's not over and this is still ongoing and we still need to take these precautions, and it's still valuable for me to get vaccinated. So I'm sorry that it took this rebound of cases and more people in the hospital and more people, you know, critically ill to get that message across. But I think that does bring that message across as well. And I think it is a mix. You know, for some people, that protection of others message works well. For others, it's not as compelling, and they're really looking at protection for themselves and having that sort of individualistic cultural lens that they look at it through, and so they need to feel like there's a risk to them for them to pursue vaccine.
Dr. Babcock, good to have your views today. Thanks so much for being with us. Dr. Hilary Babcock is an infectious disease expert at Washington University School of Medicine. Yes, we lost Mike Osterholm, epidemiologist and the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., the House begins hearings on why and how insurrectionists were able to breach Capitol security on January 6th and what they did once they got in, what has happened with the prosecutions that have followed. And we will give you full coverage of that tomorrow at 9.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. Thanks for listening.